Barefoot, she hurried downstairs to the kitchen, where she hesitantly withdrew a butcher's knife from the rack near the stove. Light trickled like a thin stream of quicksilver along the well-honed cutting edge. As she turned the gleaming knife in her hand, she saw her eyes reflected in the broad, flat blade. She stared at herself in the polished steel, wondering if she could possibly use such a horrible weapon against another human being, even in self-defense. She hoped she would never have to find out. Upstairs again, she put the butcher's knife on the nightstand within easy reach. She took off her robe and sat on the edge of the bed, hugging herself and trying to stop shaking. "Why me?" she said aloud. "Why does he want to pick on me?" Streck said that she was pretty, but Nora knew it was not true. Her own mother had abandoned her to Aunt Violet and had returned only twice in 28 years, the last time when Nora was 6. Her father remained unknown to her, and no other Devon relatives were willing to take her in, a situation which Violet frankly attributed to Nora's uncomely appearance. So although Streck said she was pretty, it could not possibly be her that he wanted. No. What he wanted was the thrill of scaring and dominating and hurting her. There were such people. She read about them in books, newspapers. And Aunt Violet had warned her 1,000 times that if a man ever came on to her with sweet talk and smiles, he would only want to lift her up so he could later cast her down from a greater height and hurt her all the worse. After a while, the worst of the tremors passed. Nora got in bed again. Her remaining ice cream had melted, so she put the dish aside on the nightstand. She picked up the novel by Dickens and tried to involve herself once more with Pip's tale. But her attention repeatedly strayed to the phone, to the butcher's knife, and to the open door in the second-floor hall beyond, where she kept imagining she saw movement. Part 3. Travis went into the kitchen, and the dog followed him. He pointed to the refrigerator and said, "Show me. Do it again. Get me a beer. Show me how you did it." The dog did not move. Travis squatted. "Listen, Furface, who got you out of those woods, away from whatever was chasing you? I did. And who bought hamburgers for you? I did. I bathed you, fed you, gave you a home. Now you owe me. Stop being coy. If you can open that thing, do it." The dog went to the aging Frigidaire, lowered its head to the bottom corner of the enamel-coated door, gripped the edge in its jaws, and pulled backward, straining with its entire body. The rubber seal let loose with a barely audible sucking sound. The door swung open. The dog quickly insinuated itself into the gap and jumped up and braced itself with a forepaw on each side of the storage compartment. "I'll be damned," Travis said, moving closer. The retriever peered into the second shelf, where Travis had stored cans of beer, Diet Pepsi, and V8 vegetable juice. It plucked another Coors from the supply, dropped to the floor, and let the refrigerator door slip shut again as it came to Travis. He took the beer from it. Standing with a Coors in each hand, studying the dog, he said, more to himself than to the animal, "Okay, so somebody could have taught you to open a refrigerator door, and he could even have taught you how to recognize a certain brand of beer, how to distinguish it from other cans, and how to carry it to him. But we still have some mysteries here. Is it likely that the brand you were taught to recognize would be the same one I'd have in my refrigerator? Possible, yes, but not likely. Besides, I didn't give you any command. I didn't ask you to get me a beer. You did it on your own hook, as if you figured out a beer was exactly what I needed at the moment. And it was." Travis put one can down on the table. He wiped the other on his shirt, popped it open, and took a few swallows. He was not concerned that the can had been in the dog's mouth. He was too excited by the animal's amazing performance to worry about germs. Besides, it had held each can by the bottom, as if concerned about hygiene. The retriever watched him drink. When he had finished a third of the beer, Travis said, "It was almost as if you understood that I was tense, upset, and that a beer would help relax me. Now, is that crazy or what? We're talking analytical reasoning. Okay, so pets can sense their master's moods a lot of the time. But how many pets know what beer is? And how many realize what it can do to make the master more mellow? Anyway, how'd you know there was beer in the fridge? I guess you could have seen it sometime during the evening when I was fixing dinner, but still. His hands were shaking. He drank more of the beer, and the can rattled lightly against his teeth. The dog went around the red formica table to the twin cabinet doors below the sink. It opened one of these, stuck its head into the dark space, and pulled out the bag of milk-bone biscuits, which it brought straight to Travis. He laughed and said, "Well, if I can have a beer, I guess you deserve a treat of your own, huh?" He took the bag from the dog and tore it open. "Do a few milk bones mellow you out for a face?" He put the open bag on the floor. "Serve yourself. I trust you not to overindulge like an ordinary dog." He laughed again. "Hell, I think I might trust you to drive the car." The retriever finessed a biscuit out of the package, sat down with its hind leg splayed, and happily crunched up the treat. Pulling out a chair and sitting at the table, Travis said, "You give me reason to believe in miracles. Do you know what I was doing in those woods this morning?" Working its jaws, industriously grinding up the biscuit, the dog seemed to have lost interest in Travis for the moment. "I went out there on a sentimental journey, hoping to recall the pleasure I got from the Santa Anas when I was a boy, and the days before everything turned so dark. I wanted to kill a few snakes like I did when I was a kid, hike and explore and feel in tune with life like in the old days, because for a long time now, I haven't cared whether I live or die." The dog stopped chewing, swallowed hard, and focused on Travis with undivided attention. "Lately, my depressions have been blacker than midnight on the moon. Do you understand about depression, Pooch?" Leaving the milk-bone biscuits behind, the retriever got up and came to him. It gazed into his eyes with that unnerving directness and intensity that it had shown before. Meeting its stare, he said, "Wouldn't consider suicide, though. For one thing, I was raised a Catholic, and though I haven't gone to Mass in ages, I still sort of believe. And for a Catholic, suicide is a mortal sin, murder. Besides, I'm too mean and too stubborn to give up, no matter how dark things get." The retriever blinked, but did not break eye contact. "I was in those woods searching for the happiness I once knew. And then I ran into you." "Woof," it said, as if it were saying, "Good." He took its head in both hands, lowered his face to it, and said, "Depression. A feeling that existence was pointless. How would a dog know about those things, hmm? A dog has no worries, does it? To a dog, every day is a joy. So do you really understand what I'm talking about, boy? Honest to God, I think maybe you do. But am I crediting you with too much intelligence, too much wisdom, even for a magical dog, huh? Sure, you can do some amazing tricks, but that's not the same as understanding me." The retriever pulled away from him and returned to the milk-bone package. It took the bag in its teeth and shook out 20 or 30 biscuits onto the linoleum. "There you go again," Travis said. "One minute you seem half-human, and the next minute you're just a dog with a dog's interests." However, the retriever was not seeking a snack. It began to push the biscuits around with the black tip of its snout, maneuvering them into the open center of the kitchen floor one at a time, ordering them neatly end to end. "What the hell is this?" The dog had 5 biscuits arranged in a row that gradually curved to the right. It pushed a 6th into place, emphasizing the curve. As he watched, Travis hastily finished his first beer and opened the second. He had a feeling he was going to need it. The dog studied the row of biscuits for a moment, as if not quite sure what it had begun to do. It padded back and forth a few times, clearly uncertain, but eventually nudged 2 more biscuits into line. It looked at Travis, then at the shape it was creating on the floor, then nosed a 9th biscuit into place. Travis sipped some beer and waited tensely to see what would happen next. With a shake of its head and a snort of frustration, the dog went to the far end of the room and stood facing into the corner. Its head hung low. Travis wondered what it was doing, and then somehow he got the idea that it had gone into the corner in order to concentrate. After a while, it returned and pushed the 10th and 11th milk bones into place, enlarging the pattern. He was stricken again by the premonition that something of great importance was about to happen. Goose flesh dimpled his arms. This time he was not disappointed. The golden retriever used 19 biscuits to form a crude but recognizable question mark on the kitchen floor, then raised its expressive eyes to Travis. A question mark? Meaning, why? Why have you been so depressed? Why do you feel life is pointless, empty? The dog apparently understood what he had told it. All right, okay, so maybe it didn't understand language exactly, didn't follow every word that he spoke, but it somehow perceived the meaning of what he was saying, or at least enough of the meaning to arouse its interest and curiosity. And by God, if it also understood the purpose of a question mark, then it was capable of abstract thinking. The very concept of simple symbols, like alphabets, numbers, question marks, and exclamation points, serving as shorthand for communicating complex ideas. Well, that required abstract thinking. And abstract thinking was reserved for only one species on Earth, humankind. This golden retriever was demonstrably not human. But somehow it had come into possession of intellectual skills that no other animal could claim. Travis was stunned. But there was nothing accidental about the question mark. Crude, but not accidental. Somewhere the dog must have seen the symbol and been taught its meaning. Statistical theorists said an infinite number of monkeys equipped with an infinite number of typewriters would eventually be able to recreate every line of great English prose merely by random chance. He figured that this dog forming a milkbone question mark in about 2 minutes flat, merely by purest chance, was about 10 times as unlikely as all those damn monkeys recreating Shakespeare's plays. The dog was watching him expectantly. Getting up, he found he was a bit shaky in the legs. He went to the carefully arranged biscuits, scattered them across the floor, and returned to his chair. The retriever studied the disarranged milk bones, regarded Travis inquiringly, sniffed at the biscuits again, and seemed baffled. Travis waited. The house was unnaturally quiet, as if the flow of time had been suspended for every living creature, machine, and object on Earth, though not for him, the retriever, or the contents of the kitchen. At last, the dog began to push the biscuits around with its nose as it had done before. In a minute or two, it formed a question mark. Travis chugged some Coors. His heart was hammering. His palms were sweaty. He was filled with both wonder and trepidation, with both wild joy and fear of the unknown, simultaneously awe-stricken and bewildered. He wanted to laugh because he had never seen anything half as delightful as this dog. He also wanted to cry because only hours ago he'd thought life was bleak, dark, and pointless. But no matter how painful it was sometimes, life was, he now realized, nonetheless precious. He actually felt as if God had sent the retriever to intrigue him, to remind him that the world was full of surprises, and that despair made no sense when one had no understanding of the purpose and strange possibilities of existence. Travis wanted to laugh, but his laughter teetered on the brink of a sob. Yet when he surrendered to the sob, it became a laugh. When he attempted to stand, he knew that he was even shakier than before, too shaky. So he did the only thing he could do. He stayed in his chair and took another long swallow of Coors. Cocking its head one way and then the other, looking slightly wary, the dog watched him as if it thought he had gone mad. He had, months ago, but he was all better now. He put down the Coors and wiped tears out of his eyes with the backs of his hands. He said, "Come here, Furface." The retriever hesitated, then came to him. He ruffled and stroked its coat, scratching behind its ears. "You amaze me and scare me. I can't figure where you came from or how you got to be what you are, but you couldn't have come where you're more needed. A question mark, huh? Jesus. All right, you want to know why I felt life had no purpose or joy for me? I'll tell you. I will, by God. I'll sit right here and have another beer and tell it to a dog. But first, I'm going to name you." The retriever blew air out of its nostrils as if to say, "Well, it's about time." Holding the dog's head, looking straight into its eyes, Travis said, Einstein. From now on, fur face, your name is Einstein. Part 4. Streck called again at 9:10. Nora snatched up the phone in the first ring, fiercely determined to tell him off and make him leave her alone. But for some reason she clenched up again and was unable to speak. In a repulsively intimate tone of voice, he said, "You miss me, prettiness? Mm-hmm. Do you wish I'd come to you? Be a man for you?" She hung up. "What's wrong with me?" she wondered. "Why can't I tell him to go away and stop bothering me?" Maybe her speechlessness grew from a secret desire to hear a man, any man, even a disgusting specimen like Streck, call her pretty. Although he was not the kind who would be capable of tenderness or affection, she could listen to him and imagine what it would be like to have a good man say sweet things to her. "Well, you're not pretty," she told herself, "and never ever will be, so stop mooning around. Next time he calls, tell him off." She got out of bed and went down the hall to the bathroom, where there was a mirror. Following Violet Devon's example, Nora did not have mirrors anywhere in the house except the bathrooms. She did not like to look at herself because what she saw was saddening. This one night, however, she wanted to take a look at herself because Streck's flattery, though cold and calculated, had stirred her curiosity. Not that she hoped to see some fine quality that she had never seen before, no. From duckling to swan overnight, that was a frivolous, hopeless dream. Rather, she wanted to confirm that she was undesirable. Streck's unwanted interest rattled Nora, because she was comfortable in her homeliness and solitude, and she wanted to reassure herself that he was mocking her, that he would not act upon his threats, that her peaceful solitude would endure. Or so she told herself as she stepped into the bathroom and switched on the light. The narrow chamber had pale blue tile from floor to ceiling with a white tile border, a huge clawfoot tub, white porcelain and brass fixtures. The large mirror was somewhat streaked with age. She looked at her hair, which Streck said was beautiful, dark, glossy. But it was of one shade, without natural highlights. To her it wasn't glossy, but oily, although she had washed it that morning. She looked quickly at her brow, cheekbones, nose, jawline, lips, and chin. She tentatively traced her features with one hand, but she saw nothing to intrigue a man. At last, reluctantly, she stared into her eyes, which Streck had called lovely. They were a dreary, lusterless shade of gray. She could not bear to meet her own gaze for more than a few seconds. Her eyes confirmed her low opinion of her appearance, but also, well, in her own eyes, she saw a smoldering anger that disturbed her, that was not like her, an anger at what she had let herself become. Of course, that made no sense whatsoever, because she was what nature had made her, a mouse, and she could do nothing about that. Turning from the mottled mirror, she felt a pang of disappointment that her self-inspection had not resulted in a single surprise or reevaluation. Immediately, however, she was shocked and appalled by that disappointment. She stood in the bathroom doorway, shaking her head, amazed by her own befuddled thought processes. Did she want to be appealing to Streck? Of course not. He was weird, sick, dangerous. The very last thing she wanted was to appeal to him. Maybe she wouldn't mind if another man looked on her with favor, but not Streck. She should get on her knees and thank God for creating her as she was, because if she were at all attractive, Streck would make good on his threats. He'd come here, and he'd rape her, maybe murder her. Who knew about a man like that? Who knew what his limits were? She wasn't being a nervous old maid when she worried about murder. Not these days. The newspapers were full of it. She realized that she was defenseless, and she hurried back to the bedroom where she had left the butcher's knife. Part 5. Most people believe psychoanalysis is a cure for unhappiness. They are sure they could overcome all their problems and achieve peace of mind if only they could understand their own psychology, understand the reasons for their negative moods and self-destructive behavior. But Travis had learned this was not the case. For years he engaged in unsparing self-analysis, and long ago he figured out why he had become a loner who was unable to make friends. However, in spite of that understanding, he had not been able to change. Now, as midnight approached, he sat in the kitchen, drank another Coors, and told Einstein about his self-imposed emotional isolation. Einstein sat before him, unmoving, never yawning, as if intently interested in his tale. I was a loner as a kid, right from the start, but I wasn't entirely without friends. It was just that I always preferred my own company. I guess it's my nature. I mean, when I was a kid, I hadn't yet decided that my being friends with someone was a danger to him. Travis's mother had died giving birth to him, and he knew all about that from an early age. In time, her death would seem like an omen of what was to come, and it would take on a terrible importance. But that was later. As a kid, he wasn't yet burdened with guilt. Not until he was 10. That was when his brother Harry died. Harry was 12, 2 years older than Travis. One Monday morning in June, Harry talked Travis into walking 3 blocks to the beach, although their father had expressly forbidden them to go swimming without him. It was a private cove without a public lifeguard, and they were the only 2 swimmers in sight. Harry got caught in an undertow, Travis told Einstein. We were in the water together no more than 10 feet apart, and the damn undertow got him, sucked him away. But it didn't get me. I even went after him, tried to save him. So I should have swum straight into the same current. But I guess it changed course just after it snatched Harry away, because I came out of the water alive. He stared at the top of the kitchen table for a long moment, seeing not the red formica, but the rolling, treacherous blue-green sea. I loved my big brother more than anyone in the world. Einstein whined softly, as if in commiseration. Nobody blamed me for what happened to Harry. He was the older one. He was supposed to be the more responsible. But I felt, well, if the undertow took Harry, it should have taken me, too. A night wind blew in from the west, rattled a loose window pane. After taking a swallow of beer, Travis said, The summer I was 14, I wanted very badly to go to tennis camp. Tennis was my big enthusiasm then. So my dad enrolled me in a place down near San Diego, a full month of intense instruction. He drove me there on a Sunday, but we never made it. Just north of Oceanside, a trucker fell asleep at the wheel. His rig jumped the median, and we were wiped. Dad was killed instantly. Broken neck, broken back, skull crushed, chest caved in. I was in the front seat beside him, and I came out of it with a few cuts, bruises, and 2 broken fingers. The dog was studying him intently. It was just like with Harry. Both of us should have died, my father and me. But I escaped. And we wouldn't have been making the damn drive if I hadn't agitated like hell about tennis camp. So this time, there was no getting around it. Maybe I couldn't be blamed for my mother dying in childbirth, and maybe I couldn't be pinned with Harry's death, but this one... Anyway, although I wasn't always at fault, it began to be clear that I was jinxed, that it wasn't safe for people to get too close to me. When I loved somebody, really loved them, they were sure as shit going to die. Only a child could have been convinced that those tragic events meant he was a walking curse. But Travis was a child then, only 14, and no other explanation was so neat. He was too young to understand that the mindless violence of nature and fate often had no meaning that could be ascertained. At 14, he needed meaning in order to cope. So he told himself that he was cursed, that if he made any close friends, he would be sentencing them to early death. Being somewhat of an introvert to begin with, he found it almost too easy to turn inward and make do with his own company. By the time he graduated from college at the age of 21, he was a confirmed loner, though maturity had given him a healthier perspective on the deaths of his mother, brother, and father. He no longer consciously thought of himself as jinxed, no longer blamed himself for what had happened to his family. He remained an introvert, without close friends, partly because he had lost the ability to form and nurture intimate relationships, and partly because he figured he could not be shattered by grief if he had no friends to lose. Habit and self-defense kept me emotionally isolated, he told Einstein. The dog rose and crossed the few feet of kitchen floor that separated them. It insinuated itself between his legs and and put its head in his lap. Petting Einstein, Travis said, "Had no idea what I wanted to do after college, and there was a military draft then, so I joined up before they could call me. Chose the army. Special forces. Liked it. Maybe because, well, there was a sense of camaraderie, and I was forced to make friends. See, I pretended not to want close ties with anyone, but I must have, because I put myself in a situation where it was inevitable. Decided to make a career out of the service. When Delta Force, the anti-terrorist group, was formed, that's where I finally landed. The guys in Delta were tight, real buddies. They called me the Mute and Harpo because I wasn't a talker, but in spite of myself, I made friends. Then on our 11th operation, my squad was flown into Athens to take the U.S. embassy back from a group of Palestinian extremists who'd seized it. They'd killed 8 staff members and were still killing 1 an hour, wouldn't negotiate. We hit them quick and sneaky. It was a fiasco. They'd booby-trapped the place. 9 men in my squad died. I was the only survivor. A bullet in my thigh, shrapnel in my ass, but a survivor. Einstein raised his head from Travis's lap. Travis thought he saw sympathy in the dog's eyes, maybe because that was what he wanted to see. That's 8 years ago when I was 28. Left the army, came home to California, got a real estate license because my dad had sold real estate and I didn't know what else to do. Did real well. Maybe because I didn't care if they bought the houses I showed them. Didn't push, didn't act like a salesman. Fact is, I did so well that I became a broker, opened my own office, hired salespeople. Which was how he had met Paula. She was a tall, blonde beauty, bright and amusing. And she could sell real estate so well that she joked about having lived an earlier life in which she had represented the Dutch colonists when they had bought Manhattan from the Indians for beads and trinkets. She was smitten with Travis. That's what she told him. "Mr. Cornell, sir, I am smitten. I think it's your strong silent act. Best Clint Eastwood imitation I've ever seen." Travis resisted her at first. He did not believe he would jinx Paula. At least he didn't consciously believe it. He had not openly reverted to childhood superstition. But he did not want to risk the pain of loss again. Undeterred by his hesitancy, she pursued him. And in time, he had to admit he was in love with her. So in love that he told her about his lifelong tag game with death, something of which he spoke to no one else. "Listen," Paula said, "you won't have to mourn me. I'm going to outlive you because I'm not the type to bottle up my feelings. I take out my frustrations on those around me, so I'm bound to shave a decade off your life." They had been married in a simple courthouse ceremony 4 years ago, the summer after Travis's 32nd birthday. He had loved her. Oh, God, how he had loved her. To Einstein, he said, "We didn't know it then, but she had cancer on our wedding day. 10 months later, she was dead." The dog put its head down in his lap again. For a while, Travis could not continue. He drank some beer. He stroked the dog's head. In time, he said, "After that, I tried to go on as usual. Always prided myself in going on, facing up to anything. Keeping my chin up, all that bullshit. Kept the real estate office running another year, but none of it mattered anymore. Sold it 2 years ago. Cashed in all my investments, too. Turned everything into cash and socked it in the bank. Rented this house. Spent the last 2 years, well, brooding. And I got squirrely. Hardly a surprise, huh? Squirrely as hell. Came full circle, you see, right back to what I believed when I was a kid. That I was a danger to anyone who gets close to me. But you changed me, Einstein. You turned me around in one day. I swear it's like you were sent to show me that life's mysterious, strange, and full of wonders, and that only a fool withdraws from it willingly and lets it pass him by." The dog was peering up at him again. He lifted his beer can, but it was empty. Einstein went to the fridge and got another Coors. Taking the can from the dog, Travis said, "Now, after hearing the whole sorry thing, what do you think? You think it's wise for you to hang around with me? You think it's safe?" Einstein woofed. Was that a yes? Einstein rolled onto his back and put all 4 legs in the air, baring his belly as he had done earlier when he had permitted Travis to collar him. Putting his beer aside, Travis got off his chair, settled on the floor, and stroked the dog's belly. "All right," he said. "All right. But don't die on me, damn you. Don't you dare die on me." Part 6. Nora Devon's telephone rang again at 11 o'clock. It was Streck.
"Are you in bed now, prettiness?"
She did not reply.
"Do you wish I was there with you?"
Since the previous call, she'd thought about how to handle him, and had come up with several threats she hoped might work. She said,
"If you don't leave me alone, I'll go to the police."
"Nora, do you sleep in the nude?"
She was sitting in bed. She sat up straighter, tense, rigid.
"I'll go to the police and say you tried to force yourself on me. I will, I swear I will."
"I'd like to see you in the nude," he said, ignoring her threat.
"I'll lie. I'll say you raped me."
"Wouldn't you like me to put my hands on your breasts, Nora?"
Dull cramps in her stomach forced her to bend forward in bed.
"I'll have the telephone company put a tap on my line, record all the calls I get so I'll have proof."
"Kiss you all over, Nora? Wouldn't that be nice?"
The cramps were getting worse. She was shaking uncontrollably, too. Her voice cracked repeatedly as she employed her final threat.
"I have a gun! I have a gun!"
"Tonight you'll dream about me, Nora. I'm sure you will. You'll dream about me kissing you everywhere, all over your pretty body."
She slammed the phone down. Rolling onto her side on the bed, she hunched her shoulders and drew up her knees and hugged herself. The cramps had no physical cause. They were strictly an emotional reaction, generated by fear and shame and rage and enormous frustration. Gradually, the pain passed. Fear subsided, leaving only rage. She was so wrenchingly innocent of the world and its ways, so unaccustomed to dealing with people, that she couldn't function unless she restricted herself to the house, to a private world without human contact. She knew nothing about social interaction. She had not even been capable of holding a polite conversation with Garrison Dilworth, Aunt Violet's attorney, Nora's attorney now, during their meetings to settle the estate. She had answered his questions as succinctly as possible, and had sat in his presence with her eyes downcast and her cold hands fidgeting in her lap, crushingly shy. Afraid of her own lawyer. If she couldn't deal with a kind man like Garrison Dilworth, how could she ever handle a beast like Art Streck? In the future, she wouldn't dare have a repairman in her home, no matter what broke down. She would just have to live in ever-worsening decay and ruin because the next man might be another Streck, or worse. In the tradition established by her aunt, Nora already had groceries delivered from a neighborhood market, so she did not have to go out to shop. But now she would be afraid to let the delivery boy into the house. He had never been the least aggressive, suggestive, or in any way insulting. But one day he might see the vulnerability that Streck had seen. She hated Aunt Violet. On the other hand, Violet had been right. Nora was a mouse. Like all mice, her destiny was to run, to hide, to cower in the dark. Her fury abated just as her cramps had done. Loneliness took the place of anger, and she wept quietly. Later, sitting with her back against the headboard, blotting her reddened eyes with Kleenex and blowing her nose, she bravely vowed not to become a recluse. Somehow she would find the strength and courage to venture out into the world more than she'd done before. She would meet people. She would get to know the neighbors that Violet had more or less shunned. She would make friends. By God, she would. And she wouldn't let Streck intimidate her. She would learn how to handle other problems that came along as well. And in time, she would be a different woman from the one she was now. A promise to herself. A sacred vow. She considered unplugging the telephone, thus foiling Streck, but she was afraid she might need it. What if she woke, heard someone in the house, and was unable to plug in the phone fast enough? Before turning out the lights and pulling up the covers, she closed the lockless bedroom door and braced it shut with the armchair, which she tilted under the knob. In bed, in the dark, she felt for the butcher's knife, which she'd placed on the nightstand. And she was reassured when she put her hand directly upon it without fumbling. Nora lay on her back, eyes open, wide awake. Pale amber light from the street lamps found its way through the shuttered windows. The ceiling was banded with alternating strips of black and faded gold, as if a tiger of infinite length were leaping over the bed in a jump that would never end. She wondered if she would ever sleep easily again. She also wondered if she would find anyone who could care about her, and for her, out there in the bigger world that she had vowed to enter. Was there no one who could love a mouse and treat it gently? Far away, a train whistle played a one-note dirge in the night. It was a hollow, cold, and mournful sound. Part 7. Vince Nasco had never been so busy, or so happy. When he called the usual Los Angeles number to report success at the Yarbeck house, he was referred to another public phone. This one was between a frozen yogurt shop and a fish restaurant on Balboa Island in Newport Harbor. There he was called by the contact with the sexy, throaty, yet little girl voice. She spoke circumspectly of murder, never using incriminating words, but employing exotic euphemisms that would mean nothing in a court of law. She was calling from another payphone, one she had chosen at random, so there was virtually no chance that either of them was tapped. But it was a Big Brother world, where you didn't dare take risks. The woman had a third job for him, three in one day. As Vince watched the evening traffic inching past on the narrow island street, the woman, whom he had never seen and whose name he didn't know, gave him the address of Dr. Albert Hudson in Laguna Beach. Hudson lived with his wife and a 16-year-old son. Both Dr. and Mrs. Hudson had to be hit. However, the boy's fate was in Vince's hands. If the kid could be kept out of it, fine. But if he saw Vince and could serve as a witness, he had to be eliminated too.
"Your discretion," the woman said.
Vince already knew that he would erase the kid, because killing was more useful to him, more energizing, if the victim was young. It had been a long time since he'd blown away a really young one, and the prospect excited him.
"I can only emphasize," the contact said, driving Vince a little nuts with her breathy pauses, "that this option must be exercised with all due speed. We want the deal concluded tonight. By tomorrow, the competition will be aware of what we're trying to swing, and they'll get in our way."
Vince knew the competition must be the police. He was being paid to kill three doctors in a single day. Doctors, when he had never killed a doctor before. So he knew there was something that linked them, something the cops would pick up on when they found Weatherby in the trunk of his car and Elizabeth Yarbeck beaten to death in her bedroom. Vince didn't know what the link was, because he never knew anything about the people he was hired to kill, and he didn't really want to know anything. It was safer that way. But the cops would link Weatherby with Yarbeck and both of them with Hudson, so if Vince did not get to Hudson tonight, the police would be providing the man with protection by tomorrow. Vince said,
"I wonder, do you want the option exercised in the same way as the other two deals today? You want a pattern?"
He was thinking maybe he should burn the Hudson house to the ground with them in it to cover the murders.
"No, we absolutely do want the pattern," the woman said. "Same as the others. We want them to know we've been busy."
"I see.
We want to tweak their noses," she said, and laughed softly. "We want to rub in the salt."
Vince hung up and walked to the Jolly Roger for dinner. He had vegetable soup, a hamburger, fries, onion rings, coleslaw, chocolate cake with ice cream, and as an afterthought, apple pie, all of which he washed down with 5 cups of coffee. He was ordinarily a big eater, but his appetite increased dramatically after a job. In fact, when he finished the pie, he wasn't full. Understandable. In one busy day, he had absorbed the life energies of Davis Weatherby and the Yarbecks. He was overcharged, a racing engine. His metabolism was in high gear. He would need more fuel for a while, until his body stored the excess life energies and biological batteries for future use. The ability to absorb the very life force of his victim was the gift that made him different from all other men. Because of the gift, he would always be strong, vital, alert. He would live forever. He had never divulged the secret of his splendid gift to the throaty-voiced woman, or to any of the people for whom he worked. Few people were imaginative and open-minded enough to consider seriously such an amazing talent. Vince kept it to himself, because he was afraid they'd think he was crazy. Outside the restaurant, he stood on the sidewalk for a while, just breathing deeply, savoring the crisp sea air. A chilly night wind blew off the harbor, sweeping scrap paper and purple jacaranda blossoms along the pavement. Vince felt terrific. He believed he was as much of an elemental force as were the sea and wind. From Balboa Island, he drove south to Laguna Beach. At 11:20, he parked his van across the street from the Hudson House. It was in the hills, a single-story home slung on a steep slope to take advantage of ocean views. He saw lights in a couple of windows. He climbed between the seats and sat down in the back of the van, out of sight, to wait until all of the Hudsons had gone to bed. Soon after leaving the Yarbeck House, he had changed out of his blue suit into gray slacks, a white shirt, a maroon sweater, and a dark blue nylon jacket. Now, in the darkness, he had nothing to do except take his weapons out of a cardboard box, where they were hidden beneath two loaves of bread, a four-roll package of toilet tissue, and other items that gave the impression he had just been to the market. The Walther P-38 was fully loaded. After finishing the job at the Yarbeck House, he had screwed a fresh silencer onto the barrel, one of the new short ones, that thanks to the high-tech revolution was half the length of older models. He set the gun aside. He had a 6-inch switchblade knife. He put it in the right front pocket of his trousers. When he had wound the wire garrote into a tight coil, he tucked it into the left inside pocket of his jacket. He had a sap weighted with lead pellets. That went into his right exterior jacket pocket. He did not expect to use anything but the gun. However, he liked to be prepared for any eventuality. On some jobs, he had used an Uzi submachine gun that had been illegally converted for automatic fire. But the current assignment did not require heavy armament. He also had a small leather packet, half the size of a shaving kit, which contained a few simple burglary tools. He did not bother to inspect those instruments. He might not even need them, because a lot of people were amazingly lax about home security, leaving doors and windows unlocked during the night, as if they believed they were living in a 19th-century Quaker village. At 11:40, he leaned between the front seats and looked through the side window at the Hudson House. All the lights were out. Good. They were in bed. To give them time to fall asleep, he sat down in the back of the van again, ate a Mr. Goodbar, and thought about how he'd spend some of the substantial fees that he had earned just since this morning. He'd been wanting a power ski, one of those clever machines that made it possible to water ski without a boat. He was an ocean lover. Something about the sea drew him. He felt at home in the tides and was most fully alive when he was moving in harmony with great surging dark masses of water. He enjoyed scuba diving, wind sailing, and surfing. His teenage years had been spent more on the beach than in school. He still rode the board now and then, when the surf was high. But he was 28, and surfing now seemed tame to him. He wasn't as easily thrilled as he had once been. He liked speed these days. He pictured himself skimming over a slate-dark sea on power skis, hammered by the wind, jolted by an endless series of impacts with eternally incoming breakers, riding the Pacific as a rodeo cowboy would ride a bronc. At 12:15, he got out of the van. He tucked the pistol under the waistband of his trousers and crossed the silent, deserted street to the Hudson House. He let himself through an unlocked wooden gate onto a side patio, brightened only by moonlight, filtered through the leafy branches of an enormous sheltering coral tree. He paused to pull on a pair of supple leather gloves. Mirrored by moonbeams, a sliding glass door connected the patio with the living room. It was locked. A penlight, extracted from the packet of burglary tools, also revealed a wooden pole laid in the interior track of the door to prevent it from being forced. The Hudsons were more security conscious than most people. But Vince was unconcerned. He fixed a small suction cup to the glass, used a diamond cutter to carve a circle in the pane near the door handle, and quietly removed the cutout with the cup. He reached through the hole and disengaged the lock. He cut another circle near the sill, reached inside, and removed the wooden pole from the track, pushing it under the drawn drapes into the room beyond. He did not have to worry about dogs. The woman with the sexy voice had told him that the Hudsons had no house pets. That was one reason why he liked working for these particular employers. Their information was always extensive and accurate. Easing the door open, he slipped through the closed drapes into the dark living room. He stood for a moment, letting his eyes adjust to the gloom, listening. The house was tomb silent. He found the boys' room first. It was illuminated by the green glow of the numerals on a digital clock radio. The teenager was lying on his side, snoring softly. 16. Very young. Vince liked them very young. He moved around the bed and crouched along the side of it, face to face with the sleeper. With his teeth, he pulled the glove off his left hand. Holding the pistol in his right hand, he touched the muzzle to the underside of the boy's chin. The kid woke at once. Vince slapped his bare hand firmly against the boy's forehead and simultaneously fired the gun. The bullet smashed up through the soft underside of the kid's chin, through the roof of his mouth, into his brain, killing him instantly. Snap! An intense charge of life energy burst out of the dying body and into Vince. It was such pure vital energy that he whimpered with pleasure as he felt it surge into him. For a while he crouched beside the bed, not trusting himself to move. Transported. Breathless. At last, in the dark, he kissed the dead boy on the lips and said, "I accept. Thank you. I accept." He crept, cat swift, cat silent, through the house and quickly found the master bedroom. Sufficient light was provided by another digital clock with green numerals and the soft glow of a nightlight coming through the open bathroom door. Dr. and Mrs. Hudson were both asleep. Vince killed her first. Snap! Without waking her husband. She slept in the nude, so after he received her sacrifice, he put his head to her bare breasts and listened to the stillness of her heart. He kissed her nipples and murmured, "Thank you." When he circled the bed, turned on a nightstand lamp, and woke Dr. Hudson, the man was at first confused, until he saw his wife's staring, sightless eyes. Then he shouted and grabbed for Vince's arm, and Vince clubbed him over the head twice with the butt of the gun. Vince dragged the unconscious Hudson, who also slept in the nude, into the bathroom. Again he found adhesive tape, with which he was able to bind the doctor's wrists and ankles. He filled the tub with cold water and wrestled Hudson into it. That frigid bath revived the doctor. In spite of being naked and bound, Hudson tried to push up out of the cold water, tried to launch himself at Vince. Vince hit him in the face with the pistol and shoved him down into the tub again.
"Who are you? What do you want?"
Hudson spluttered as his face came up out of the water.
"I've killed your wife and your son, and I'm going to kill you."
Hudson's eyes seemed to sink back into his damp, pasty face.
"Jimmy? Oh, not Jimmy. Really, no."
"Your boy is dead," Vince insisted. "I blew his brains out." At the mention of his son, Hudson broke. He did not burst into tears, did not begin to keen, nothing as dramatic as that. But his eyes went dead. Blink, just that abruptly, like a light going out. He stared at Vince, but there was no fear or anger in him anymore. Vince said, "What you've got here is two choices, die easy or die hard. You tell me what I want to know, and I let you die easy, quick and painless. You get stubborn on me, and I can draw it out for 5 or 6 hours." Dr. Hudson stared, except for bright ribbons of fresh blood that banded his face. He was very white, wet and sickly pale, like some creature that swam eternally in the deepest reaches of the sea. Vince hoped the guy wasn't catatonic. "What I want to know is what you have in common with Davis Weatherby and Elizabeth Yarbeck." Hudson blinked, focused on Vince. His voice was hoarse and tremulous.
"Davis and Liz? What are you talking about?"
"You know them." Hudson nodded.
"How do you know them? Go to school together? Live next door at one time? Shaking his head, Hudson said, We used to work together at Banodyne.
What's Banodyne?
Banodyne Laboratories.
Where's that?
Here in Orange County, Hudson said. He gave an address in the city of Irvine.
What did you do there?
Research, but I left 10 months ago. Weatherby and Yarbeck still work there, but I don't.
What sort of research?
Vince asked. Hudson hesitated.
Vince said, quick and painless, or hard and nasty?
The doctor told him about the research he had been involved with at Banodyne. The Francis Project. The experiments. The dogs. The story was incredible. Vince made Hudson run through some of the details 3 or 4 times before he was finally convinced the story was true. When he was sure he had squeezed everything out of the man, Vince shot Hudson in the face, point blank, the quick death he'd promised. Snap! Back in the van, driving down the night-draped Laguna Hills, away from the Hudson house, Vince thought about the dangerous step he had taken. Usually, he knew nothing about his targets. That was safest for him and for his employers. Ordinarily, he didn't want to know what the poor saps had done to bring so much grief on themselves, because knowing would bring him grief. But this was no ordinary situation. He had been paid to kill 3 doctors, not medical doctors, as it turned out now, but scientists, all of them upstanding citizens, plus any members of their families who happened to get in the way. Extraordinary. Tomorrow's papers weren't going to have enough room for all the news. Something very big was going on, something so important that it might provide him with a once-in-a-lifetime edge, with a shot at money so big he would need help to count it. The money might come from selling the forbidden knowledge he had pried out of Hudson, if he could figure out who would like to buy it. But knowledge was not only saleable, it was also dangerous. Ask Adam, ask Eve. If his current employers, the sexy-voiced lady and the other people in L.A., learned that he had broken the most basic rule of his trade, if they knew that he had interrogated one of his victims before wasting him, they would put out a contract on Vince. The hunter would become the hunted. Of course, he didn't worry a lot about dying. He had too much life stored up in him. Other people's lives. More lives than 10 cats. He was going to live forever. He was pretty sure of that. But, well, he didn't know for certain how many lives he had to absorb in order to ensure immortality. Sometimes he felt that he'd already achieved a state of invincibility, eternal life. But at other times, he felt that he was still vulnerable, and that he would have to take more life energy into himself before he would reach the desired state of godhood. Until he knew beyond doubt that he had arrived at Olympus, it was best to exercise a little caution. Banodyne. The Francis Project. If what Hudson said was true, the risk Vince was taking would be well rewarded when he found the right buyer for the information. He was going to be a rich man. Part 8. Wes Dahlberg had lived alone in a stone cabin in Upper Holy Jim Canyon on the eastern edge of Orange County for 10 years. His only light came from Coleman lanterns, and the only running water in the place was from a hand pump in the kitchen sink. His toilet was in an outhouse with a quarter moon carved on the door, as a joke, about 100 feet from the back of the cabin. Wes was 42, but he looked older. His face was wind-scoured and sun-leathered. He wore a neatly trimmed beard with a lot of white whiskers. Although he appeared aged beyond his true years, his physical condition was that of a 25-year-old. He believed his good health resulted from living close to nature. Tuesday night, May 18th, by the silvery light of a hissing Coleman lantern, he sat at the kitchen table until 1 in the morning. Sipping homemade plum wine and reading a McGee novel by John D. MacDonald. Wes was, as he put it, an antisocial curmudgeon born in the wrong century, who had little use for modern society. But he liked to read about McGee because McGee swam in that messy, nasty world out there and never let the murderous currents sweep him away. When he finished the book at 1 o'clock, Wes went outside to get more wood for the fireplace.
Wind-swayed branches of sycamores cast vague moon shadows on the ground, and the glossy surfaces of rustling leaves shone dully with pale reflections of the lunar light. Coyotes howled in the distance as they chased down a rabbit or other small creature. Nearby, insects sang in the brush, and a chill wind soughed through the inner reaches of the forest. His supply of cordwood was stored in a lean-to that extended along the entire north side of the cabin. He pulled the latch peg out of the hasp on the double doors. He was so familiar with the arrangement of the wood in the storage space that he worked blindly in its lightless confines, filling a sturdy tin hod with half a dozen logs. He carried the hod out in both hands, put it down, and turned to close the doors. He realized the coyotes and the insects had all fallen silent. Only the wind still had a voice. Frowning, he turned to look at the dark forest that encircled the small clearing in which his cabin stood. Something growled. Wes squinted at the night-swaddled woods, which suddenly seemed less well illuminated by the moon than they had been a moment ago. The growling was deep and angry, not like anything he'd heard out there before in 10 years of nights alone. Wes was curious, even concerned, but not afraid. He stood very still, listening. A minute ticked by, and he heard nothing further. He finished closing the lean-to doors, pegged the latch, and picked up the hod full of cordwood. Growling again. Then silence. Then the sound of dry brush and leaves crackling, crunching, snapping underfoot. Judging by the sound, it was about 30 yards away, just a bit west of the outhouse, back in the forest. The thing grumbled again, louder this time, closer, too, not more than 20 yards away now. He could still not see the source of the sound. The deserter moon continued to hide behind a narrow filigree band of clouds. Listening to the thick, guttural yet ululant growling, Wes was suddenly uneasy. For the first time in 10 years as a resident of Holy Jim, he felt he was in danger. Carrying the hod, he headed quickly toward the back of the cabin and the kitchen door. The rustling of displaced brush grew louder. The creature in the woods was moving faster than before. Hell, it was running! Wes ran, too. The growling escalated into hard, vicious snarls, an eerie mix of sounds that seemed one part dog, part pig, part cougar, part human, and one part something else altogether. It was almost at his heels. As he sprinted around the corner of the cabin, Wes swung the hod and threw it toward where he judged the animal to be. He heard the cordwood flying loose and slamming to the ground, heard the metal hod clanging end over end, but the snarling only grew closer and louder, so he knew he had missed. He hurried up the 3 back steps, threw open the kitchen door, stepped inside, and slammed the door behind him. He slipped the latch bolt in place, a security measure he had not used in 9 years, not since he had grown accustomed to the peacefulness of the canyon. He went through the cabin to the front door and latched it, too. He was surprised by the intensity of the fear that had overcome him. Even if a hostile animal was out there, perhaps a crazed bear that had come down from the mountains, he could not open doors and follow him into the cabin. There was no need to engage the locks, yet he felt better for having done so. He was operating on instinct, and he was a good enough outdoorsman to know that instincts ought to be trusted even when they resulted in seemingly irrational behavior. Okay, so he was safe. No animal could open a door. Certainly a bear couldn't, and it was most likely a bear. But it hadn't sounded like a bear. That's what had Wes Dahlberg so spooked. It had not sounded like anything that could possibly be roaming those woods. He was familiar with his animal neighbors, knew all the howls, cries, and other noises they made. The only light in the front room was from the fireplace, and it did not dispel the shadows in the corners. Phantoms of reflected firelight cavorted across the walls. For the first time, Wes would have welcomed electricity. He owned a Remington 12-gauge shotgun with which he hunted small game to supplement his diet of store-bought foods. It was on a rack in the kitchen. He considered getting it down and loading it, but now that he was safely behind locked doors, he was beginning to be embarrassed about having panicked. Like a greenhorn, for God's sake. Like some lard-ass suburbanite shrieking at the sight of a field mouse. If he had just shouted and clapped his hands, he would most likely have frightened off the thing in the brush. Even if his reaction could be blamed on instinct, he had not behaved in accordance with his self.